And I started investigating that. And I said, well, why do some messages stick? Why do some messages break through when others don't? And it led me to the conclusion that the messages that work are simple. And so my book is called Simply Put, Why Clear Messages Win and How to Design Them. And, you know, it's a 208 page book about how to say something simply. So it feels like I didn't take my own advice. Right. But when you look into it, the answer is short. It's simple, but it's not easy. And there's a lot behind that.
Well, it's interesting that you say that, because I was just having a conversation, you know, summer's just now behind us, right? I mean, Labor Day was a couple of days ago. And the conversation was about coming back to school after your summer vacation. And in my industry, you know, people don't take seriously a report that is too small, mm-hmm. that is too short. It's got to have some sort of thump factor, even though nobody's going to read it. I mean, this is the real irony. And I blame our education system. And follow me here, all right?
Yeah.
When I would get back from summer vacation, the teacher would say, give me a 500-word essay on what you did on your summer vacation. And I went fishing and I went swimming.
Not enough.
That's what I did on my summer vacation. Now I have to find, you know, 494 other words to embellish. I went swimming and I went fishing. And I think that this is, you know, we measure how good content is too often by mm-hmm. how many words we're able to shove into it.
Exactly.
And I think that less is more. And so I love the premise of Simply Put, because those are the most memorable. There's a during the Civil War, there was a battle at Gettysburg, all right? And believe it or not, Abraham Lincoln was not the only speaker that day. There was a senator from Pennsylvania who was supposedly a great orator that went up there and spoke for like 2.5 hours, and nobody could remember his name or anything he said. And Abraham Lincoln comes up with the Gettysburg Address. You know, it lasts like 2 minutes, 2.5 minutes. And when he was done, people were waiting for the rest. Okay. I mean, they didn't believe it was that short, but that's what was memorized or memorable, was mm-hmm. how short it was. And if you can get your message across, and I agree with you 100%, if you could get your message across impactfully with as few words as possible, that's what people are going to remember.
Welcome to A State of Readiness, a podcast set as a fireside chat with business leaders to discuss what it takes for a company to be in a state of readiness and become a higher performance organization, with your host, Joseph Paris.
Welcome to another edition of State of Readiness. I'm your host, Joseph Paris. Today, my guest is Ben Gutman, a marketing and communication expert and author of Simply Put, Why Clear Messages Win and How to Design Them. He's an experienced marketing executive and educator on a mission to get leaders to more effectively connect by simplifying their message. Ben is a former co-founder and managing partner at Digital Natives Group, an award-winning marketing agency that worked with clients such as the NFL, I Love New York, Comcast, Universal, NBC, and many other major clients. Currently, Ben teaches digital marketing at Baruch College in New York City and consults with a range of thought leaders, venture-backed startups, and other brands. Welcome, Ben. Welcome to my show, State of Readiness. How are you doing today?
Thanks so much for having me, Joe. This is great.
Oh, I'm really happy to have another author on my podcast. I like to collect them. They always have some fascinating stories and messaging to share. Now, we got in touch with one another through another author, right? Mike Shine?
Yeah, Michael Shine, a good friend of mine. He also wrote a fantastic book, by the way, The Hype Handbook, which he gave me a blurb, and I'm very grateful for it, but I also highly, highly recommend his book.
Super, super. So, you know, let's go through a little bit of, you know, how Ben became Ben. All right. So, you know, you grew up, in downstate New York? Is that a good assumption?
Yeah, it's funny. So nobody from the area would call it downstate New York. If you're from upstate New York, you might call it downstate. But I was born in Queens. When I was a baby, moved out to Long Island. I grew up in a town called Smithtown, which is just as exciting as it sounds. And then eventually I went back into the city to go to Baruch College and to live in Manhattan. And I live in Queens again. When I was growing up, one thing that was different about my school that a lot of other schools didn't have was we had a dedicated business department. And, you know, I wasn't resonating with a ton of the other subjects, depending on how it is. I was a little too, I guess rowdy as a kid. But I landed in my first marketing class, it kind of just started to click. And I was very grateful to have that opportunity at like 15 or whatever it was when I first took marketing. And then it's been on that path ever since. I've been, I took marketing at Baruch College. Now I teach marketing at Baruch College. I ran a marketing agency for 10 years. I could talk more about that. And now I'm here. I sold that business. I wrote a book and I'm doing a lot of other fun projects.
That's kind of fascinating when, you know, not to sound like my father, but when I was growing up, you know, we had shop. And we had home economics, which wasn't how to do taxes and balance a checkbook. It was basically how do you cook, you know, and there was a typing class so you could learn how to type at however many words a minute you're supposed mm-hmm. to type. And we had one business course that I didn't take, but it was just business accounting, like accounting 101, for lack of a better term. But we didn't get into some of the more sophisticated subjects related to business management. And it's kind of fascinating that your school had a business department. Is that what you said?
Oh, yeah. And I mean, like, it's one of the knock-on effects of going to a suburban school on Long Island, right? There's a huge wealth disparity in a lot of in a lot of these communities, and you know the knock-on effect is that some of the schools get things like business departments and all these other different things, and some schools don't. I was fortunate, you know, and privileged to be able to go to one that had these different classes. The first marketing class I took was called sports marketing, which is the perfect way to get somebody who's like a 14-year-old boy into the industry. I remember we played fantasy football actually for part of the for part of our week, which was probably not very academic, but you know, my teacher found a way to tie it in. And then it was marketing. We had accounting. We did have keyboarding, which you mentioned before. Accounting was not my cup of tea. You know, I can do it and I've managed budgets for sure. But I joke that when I was in college, as part of the business core curriculum, there's a class called accounting for non-accounting majors. And I believe that the college includes that just to scare everybody who's a marketer or management or finance person into hiring accountants instead of having to do it themselves.
Well, that makes sense, doesn't it? I mean, it's all just debits and credits, right? P&L and balance sheet, it gets a little bit trickier when you get into depreciation and then forget tax accounting. That's a bit of a dark art, as far as I'm concerned. But yeah, so you got the bug, the business bug, the marketing bug in high school. And then you went on to Baruch College. So the first thing that comes to mind if it's not Baruch, don't fix it, right? But what's Baruch College's claim to fame?
So Baruch is a part of the City University of New York, which is the one of the largest public education institutions in the entire country. It is one of the best economic opportunity engines in the entire country. Hundreds of thousands of students go to CUNY throughout a bunch of different campuses, from community colleges to senior colleges to graduate programs. And it really is one of the most amazing public institutions like on the planet. I'm also biased because I went to Baruch College, which is largely I would say about 80% of the students at Baruch are business students. My parents went and they met at Queens College, which is another part of CUNY. My wife went to Baruch College, and I'm kind of biased, but I do think that CUNY is a really wonderful institution, and I'm honored to be there now as a faculty member too.
So what do you teach, if I could be so, you know, I could almost guess, but what do you teach?
It's marketing. So I teach a digital marketing course. Yeah. Who would have thought, right?
Who would have thought?
So I'm now in the beginning, first couple of weeks here of my 19th semester teaching, which is absolutely bananas to me that I've been doing it this long. The class I teach is called Digital Advertising. It's mostly seniors. It's almost all marketing majors. And so it's a very interesting part of their lives where they're about to leave and go into the real world and get jobs and start businesses. And so I take that responsibility very seriously about being oftentimes the last person between them and leaving school. Because I teach a night, it's a Monday evening class. And so the way the schedule works out for a significant chunk of them, once I say class dismissed at the end of that semester, they never come back to class ever again. And so it's a weird weight to bear, but I try to do the best of it. And I've been doing that for a long time. I've done that since I've been, you know, running my agency. It's a part-time adjunct role, but I take it very seriously, and I really enjoy it.
That sounds good. So you took this marketing course in high school and you got the bug, and it's like, it's been the thread ever since. So when I think about, you know, marketing, you know, if I was younger and I saw the series Mad Men, I would have gone into marketing too. But I would imagine it's not like that, as portrayed. Maybe it was back in the 60s, but I would imagine marketing is a lot different today than it was back then.
Oh, I mean, absolutely. Right. I do use a clip from Mad Men to explain how agencies are structured oftentimes in my class. And I did really like the show. I didn't watch it as it aired because I knew I wanted to just watch it all together at one point. Binge and it. So I binged it once it ended. The thing that I'm interested in marketing is not so much the, like, you know, the media buying and those type of things. I'm more interested in how and why people do things and how we can, you know, how we connect and communicate and I think marketing is almost like it's like applied behavioral science a lot of times.
Yeah. Yeah. So one of the things that I, I'm a bit of an engineer. I mean, that's what my companies do, industrial and systems engineering, you know, but at the end of the day, it's about the people. And I mean, it's like, if the people aren't on board, whatever it is that I try to do is going to fail. And for me to get people on board, I can't do it through facts and figures. Mm-hmm. I have to do it through storytelling. Okay. You know, and, you know, make the point through telling a story. One of my favorite poems, I don't know if you're familiar with this, is a poem called When I Heard the Learned Astronomer by Walt Whitman.
Tell me more.
Okay. So it's a very short poem. I mean, maybe it's, you know, 10 lines, but it talks about Walt Whitman. And of course, you have to realize this is 1800s, mid 1800s. He goes to this university to learn or hear the learned astronomer talk about the planets and the facts and figures. And as he's listening to the learned astronomer talking about these facts and figures, he gets upset to his stomach, so much so that he has to leave. And as he leaves, he goes into the night air, looks up at the stars, and beholds the heavens. Okay, so the idea here, what resonates with me is that, you know, here you have this person talking about the facts and figures, okay, but the reality is the stars, just going out and looking at the stars. I mean, it conveys more information than that astronomer ever can. And I think that's what effective story advertising. And I'm not going to tell you your business. You'll add, change, or delete anything I say here. But you know, the best advertising, the best marketing is through storytelling, in my opinion. At least that's what resonates with me.
Oh, absolutely. I'm going to steal that poem and I'm going to use it in some presentations probably. I love that.
Oh, it's really, it's a great poem. It's very short.
That's great. It reminds me a little bit, as a slight aside, talk about like managing people and leadership. There is some quote that I'm going to butcher because I don't have it in front of me, but it's, you have to convince somebody that they're not building a wall, that they're building a cathedral. And, you know, it's, you have to kind of figure out where are you in that chain? Are you in that storytelling, right? Because in the act of doing it, you're building that wall, you're doing, you know, you're writing that proposal and you're formatting that document, whatever it is. But when you tell that story, when you fit it into the kind of that grand plan, it ends up being something that's much more motivating and much stickier that way.
Right. Much more contextual. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm doing, launched a new offering just recently called Design Thinking for Operational Excellence. And it really is, I was introduced to it by somebody from Microsoft, but, it's problem solving through storytelling is really what it is. Very Socratic, open-ended questions. And, you know, you're trying to connect with the audience as you're trying to solve the problem. And I think it's very similar to marketing. You know, marketing is, and again, I'm not telling you your business and you'll fill in the blanks or gaps. You know, you're trying to educate in an entertaining way such that it sticks with the recipient, the messaging, that whatever it is that you're trying to get across. And, you know, marketing isn't just about product, right? It's, you know, political positions are marketing, you know, going out on a date on a Friday night or just going out on Friday night looking for a date, you know, that's marketing, the way you dress up and present yourself. So, you know, it's all very much, you know, how do we connect the dots people to people?
Mm-hmm.
So if it's people to people, and we're talking about the digital age and, you know, artificial intelligence and everything else that goes along with it, are we going, do we risk losing the people to people part?
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm glad you mentioned that we're all marketers, because I actually have that line like in the first chapter of the book, is that this is a book that I wrote, and we'll talk about them more later, but it's a book about, you know, it's nominally going to sit on the marketing shelf, right? It's and it's informed certainly by that, but it's not just for marketers. It's for anybody who's a leader, who is an entrepreneur, or is somebody who is an advocate, or anybody who just has something they want to say and communicate to other people. And that's all of us, right? It could be, you know, trying to get our spouse to pick somewhere to go to dinner. It could be trying to get our kids to get in the car to go to soccer practice. Or it could be, hey, I want to go sell 1 million units of my widget, you know, in a Super Bowl ad. And so, yeah, that I think that ultimately that's kind of the core truth here, is that we're all doing marketing on a daily basis, within whatever context that we work in professionally or that we live in personally.
Well, it's interesting that you used the word marketing and selling too, together. To me, they're two completely separate things. I mean, they might support one another, but, you know, to me, marketing is about the messaging and selling is about converting the messaging into a transaction.
Yeah. I would say, I mean, it, every company has them in different org charts and different silos. But if you look at the foundational definition of what marketing is, it's connecting producers and consumers. It's everything that is not involved in the actual production of the product is basically marketing. It's how do you bring something to market? And that includes things that you traditionally will think of that live in marketing, like advertising and you know, PR and those type of things. But also, if in the kind of at the foundational sense, sales is definitely part of marketing. Customer support, you can make an argument, is part of marketing. Anything that is involved in that chain from the people that make the thing, the people that consume the thing, distribution, that is part of marketing. And sales is almost kind of like one-to-one marketing more than anything else. Or you can say marketing is sales at scale. And they're both related for sure.
So you started in an agency, and it wasn't modeled after Mad Men. We established that. So tell me about the agency that you started. You know, what caused you to start it? When did you start it? And so on.
So I mentioned that I went to Baruch College before in my, you know, very laudatory explanation of CUNY. But I was the big nerd, and I was the president of the student government when I was there my senior year. And I was so focused on kind of doing that. And I really loved it. And I had a great team. But I wasn't really getting my internships. I wasn't really going out and being like, I want to go get a job somewhere. But fortunately, what happened is I had a professor who, he kind of realized, oh, you know, I know you kind of want to start a business. You've been talking about that. I run an agency. We need some help with digital. Maybe we can figure something out. And so me and a buddy, we go up to his office, and we meet with his partner, him and his partner, and we decide to, you know, we're going to start an agency, and we're going to work with them a little bit, and they're going to give us some digital stuff, and we're going to kind of set up shop in their basement. And I was very grateful to that opportunity, and we did that. So we left, his office was up in Westchester, which is about an hour north of the city. And so I was living in Manhattan at the time, and we would commute, take the train up from Grand Central to White Plains. I would get in my old beat up 1994 Honda Accord that I would leave parked at the train station there, and started most of the time, didn't always start, and drive to his office. I did the reverse commute for a year. We slapped our logo on the wall and we opened up shop. Our company was called Digital Natives Group because we were digital natives. We were born and raised in this technology. And we did some work with them. It wasn't, we were too stupid. We were knuckleheads. We were like 23 years old. We didn't really know what we were doing. And they worked with Fortune 500 clients and these big giant brands. So they weren't able to actually give us that much work, but we did a couple projects, and the mentorship was really helpful to have them around. But eventually we started cutting our teeth on like the local ice cream shop, the local camera shop. And we did these small projects that bit by bit started to turn into slightly bigger things. And you mentioned the storytelling before. It's about how we told our own story a lot of times in doing that sales piece of saying, okay, well, it wasn't just the ice cream shop. It was building a new brand. It was, you know, it wasn't just the camera shop. It's the biggest camera repair facility in the Northeast. And it was all these little ways which you kind of, you know, start to raise the profile of yourself, and you start to punch up to the next level bit by bit. So eventually we moved back to Queens. We got an office in Long Island City, which if 10 years ago was kind of this more industrial area. Now it's a very booming residential space. And we, you know, planted our flag, started to do more work here in the city. We ended up hiring our first employee, hiring more employees after that, working for bigger stuff, getting a bigger office down the hall. And by the end of it, we had, you know, 15 or 20 folks. And we're working with like the NFL and Comcast and the Nature Conservancy and all these other great brands. I Love New York was a big client of ours for years. And it's all because every time you do something, you tell the story a little bit differently to kind of get that next level.
Right. Right. So do you still have that agency?
No. So we ran that for 10 years. It was a great ride. I loved it. I had great partners. I had a great team. We had clients that trusted us and worked with us for years and years, which is pretty rare in that industry to have people that work with you for years and years. But eventually we looked around and said, we've done this for 10 years. Do we want to do it for the next 10 years? And the answer was, I don't know. This is the first thing we did out of school. And we want to kind of explore different things in life. So we hired a broker, went out to market, and we ended up selling the business. We actually broke the business up into two parts because selling an agency is a little bit complicated. And we did that about a year and a half ago. So what's nice about it is, you know, you get to kind of package that experience up and put like a bow on it and put it on your little mental shelf in your brain. And the way we did it was really important to us that every employee had a job at the end of it, that every client had a home. We were able to accomplish both of those things in the process, which is great.
Great. That's super. So, so you wrote a book. let's talk about that. It's called Simply Put. I kind of like it. Succinct, of course. There you go. Yeah. And what caused you to write a book? I mean, what was like, to me, I wrote a book, you know, 2017, it came out. It wasn't on my bucket list. It was never something I, you know, I said, I got to write a book. So here you have the book. It's hot off the press. And why?
Oh, so, you know, it'll sound a little self-serving, but it kind of was on my bucket list at some point to write something. I've always enjoyed writing. I've always enjoyed creating. And this is, when I look at books, it's the most kind of durable evidence of your creation. A lot of times, you know, if I put something together on a website, you know, the website eventually goes away. Put something together on social media, YouTube, whatever, eventually that kind of fades a little bit. But a book is one of those things that people have, and it's a very durable good. It lasts. People put it on their shelves. They keep it there forever. It's a very tangible item that you're able to kind of give people and leave as a souvenir almost. That's the selfish reason, right? But the real reason I wrote the book was because I saw in all that experience, either my personal life, my professional life, that so many people had a really hard time communicating. And if that was a brand that couldn't get their message out for their marketing, that's one thing. If that was somebody that, you know, had to do a presentation internally, but weren't able to spit out their ideas, and or an advocate that couldn't get their point across to their community, it's inherently challenging. And people hire agencies like ours all the time to help them with that, right? That's largely what a marketing agency does, to help people kind of figure out what to say and get it out there. And I was curious to say, well, okay, well, we kind of know it. We know the stuff, but do we know the why behind what works and what doesn't work? And I started investigating that, and I said, well, why do some messages stick? Why do some messages break through when others don't? And it led me to the conclusion that the messages that work are simple. And so my book is called Simply Put, Why Clear Messages Win and How to Design Them. And, you know, it's a 208 page book about how to say something simply. So it feels like I didn't take my own advice, right? But when you look into it, the answer is short, it's simple, but it's not easy. And there's a lot behind that.
Well, it's interesting that you say that, because I was just having a conversation, you know, summer's just now behind us, right? I mean, Labor Day was a couple of days ago. And the conversation was about coming back to school after your summer vacation. And in my industry, you know, people don't take seriously a report that is too small. Mm-hmm. It's too short. It's got to have some sort of thump factor, even though nobody's going to read it. I mean, this is the real irony. And I blame our education system. And follow me here. All right.
Yeah.
When I would get back from summer vacation, the teacher would say, give me a 500 word essay on what you did on your summer vacation. And I went fishing and I went swimming.
Not enough.
That's what I did on my summer vacation. Now I have to find, you know, 494 other words to embellish. I went swimming and I went fishing. And I think that this is, you know, we measure how good content is too often by how many words we're able to shove into it.
Exactly.
And I think that less is more. And so I love the premise of Simply Put, because those are the most memorable. There's a during the Civil War, there was a battle at Gettysburg, all right? And believe it or not, Abraham Lincoln was not the only speaker that day. There was a senator from Pennsylvania who was supposedly a great orator that went up there and spoke for like 2.5 hours, and nobody could remember his name or anything he said. And Abraham Lincoln comes up with the Gettysburg Address. You know, it lasts like 2 minutes, 2.5 minutes. And when he was done, people were waiting for the rest. Okay. I mean, they didn't believe it was that short, but that's what was memorized or memorable, was how short it was. And if you can get your message across, and I agree with you 100%, if you could get your message across impactfully with as few words as possible, that's what people are going to remember.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, it's funny you mentioned that that essay before, you know, a minimum of 500 words. I talk about that in the book. We talk about constraints, is that we often, we live in a world of minimum requirements versus maximum requirements a lot of times. So we frame things as saying, well, it has to have this many words in it, right? It has to have this many pages. It has to have this many, you know, this many slides. But that actually doesn't really reflect often what how we communicate and how we receive information. And actually, if you flip it around and you use that constraint as a forcing factor for creativity, and you say, well, the maximum is going to be 500 words, well, it ends up being a lot harder. There's a quote that's attributed to Mark Twain, which, like most quotes from Mark Twain, is probably not from him, which is, I wrote you a long letter because I didn't have time to write you a short one. And it because it takes more work to write that short one. It takes more discipline. It takes more editing to get to something a little bit shorter. But the one thing, you know, the last chapter in the book, so there's like five principles in the book. Well, the fifth one is minimal, is about, you know, having everything you need, but only what you need. And so that doesn't always mean shorter. So simple messages, messages that are fluent, that are easy to understand, perceive, act upon, all of these messages, they tend to be shorter. That doesn't mean they have to be shorter. Sometimes a couple more words, a couple more pages, a couple more sections on your website actually makes it easier to understand. It makes it feel simple. Because the thing you actually want to optimize for in terms of minimizing is not words, it's not time, it's not, you know, it's not page count. It is friction. And if something feels like it has more friction, people are going to say, you know what, I'm going to zone out. I'm not paying attention to this anymore. I'm going to go, you know, check that email that just came in. And that's the off ramp. That's the off ramp from your message. Right. If you minimize friction, though, you use words that are more easier to understand. If you break up that survey that you got to send into a few different pages, so it's not one giant ominous thing, all of those things make that a smoother experience.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. I took a journalism course in university. All right. And my natural writing style at the time was more of a playwright. A playwright mm-hmm. sets the scene, right? You know, it's like Charles Dickens. It's like, you know, 1800s in you know, musty old London. And, you know, he introduces the characters and you don't really know what's going on yet, but you're building the scene, and for lack of a better term. And in journalism, they tell you, don't bury the lead.
Yeah.
Okay. Like, you know, bring that red meat forward, bring the important stuff up on top. And as you write, the material should be less and less important and less and less relevant. Okay. So that the reader at any given point can just decide, I've read enough, and leave. Yep. And get what they needed out of it. The important stuff. It's not buried at the bottom. And I think that's a fairly, certainly it's a great advice for writing a blog, but what are your thoughts on that?
I think that's generally the right move, right? And so the idea behind that was when they used to lay out all the type to be in, you know, in the column, it's saying, hey, you know what? I can cut it off. I can cut off this paragraph because it doesn't fit in the column anymore. Literally with scissors, they would cut it to so it would fit. And yes. So, yeah, it has to be this kind of like most important up front and then less important down below. I think that is a very effective way to organize your writing. Yeah. We cannot assume that somebody cares like that. That's the kind of the big dirty secret in marketing is we think that everybody cares about everything we have to say. We have a new product. Everybody cares about it. It's very important. But in reality, most people, they don't give a shit. They don't care about what you have to say. They're living their lives perfectly fine. They woke up today and they didn't have on their to-do list to watch your commercial, to listen to your radio ad, to click on your banner ad. Every advertisement I've ever seen that you've ever seen has been against your will, right? You've never gone out and said, this is the thing I want to do today is get you know, somebody to, to pitch me on something. So we have to put that kind of humble hat on, which is that we have to connect it to things that people that care about. That's one of the other pieces here about being beneficial in your messaging. But you have to be humble and say that, okay, well, it's to break through is rare. And if you do that, you have to treat that time with respect. And that means oftentimes leading with your most important chunk of message, your strongest selling point, instead of burying that later on.
It's funny that I started laughing when you talked about the editor and, you know, the column inches. Yeah, I remember once I was writing for the school newspaper, a university newspaper, and, you know, I had this, you know, pretty substantive story, and, you know, it was probably 20 column inches long or so. And he's like, well, we're going to use 8 inches of it. And he just, honest to God, he just, as the layouts at the time, because it wasn't digital like it is today, he just measures out 8 inches and he cuts it. I'm like, what the heck, man? You know? So, yeah, that was a pretty stark reality check there as far as journalism was concerned. So let's get back to your book. You wrote it because it might have been on your bucket list, but really, I mean, when I wrote my book, there were two things I needed to sort out. The first was, why am I writing this? Mm-hmm. And the second one was, who's my audience?
Yep.
So why don't we start there? Like, why did you write the book?
Well, I wrote the book because I think we are all better off when we are better communicators. We respond better to things that are told to us, and we are more adept users of society when we're able to understand what everybody else is saying. That's obviously important. But then people have important things to say, right? They have great products they want to sell. They have big movements they want to push. They have things they want to do in their own lives. And to equip leaders with that type of message, with the ability to spit it out, to be clear about what they're doing, I think is a great thing. I think that we're all better off when we can do that. And then who is this for? I mentioned a little bit that we're all marketers a little bit. Obviously, this is, if you're in marketing, if you're a copywriter, creative director, this is going to be a great book. You're going to be able to, you're going to know some of the stuff already, obviously, but you're going to benefit from this. If you're non-marketing, but your job is somewhere in that chain between connecting producers and consumers, this is also going to be beneficial because you have to communicate and connect and show value for the thing that you're trying to move along that chain at every step. So anybody who's a business leader, entrepreneur, obviously really important. I think this, I also had in my back of my mind, I had my students and saying, okay, well, is this something that if you're in the beginning of your marketing career, what kind of mindset would be beneficial to have as you're moving through that chain? And I appreciate that you had those questions in the beginning of your process, because that's something I also talk about in the book, which is the best thing you can do is to write for one person, is to talk to one person, because crowds don't really exist. They never, like, every time that you have heard a stirring speech at a political rally, or you have, heard a commercial, again, watching the Super Bowl, you heard that in your own head, right? It was one-to-one communication, maybe at scale, but it's actually one-to-one. So it's much more effective. The best leaders, the best speakers will believe that they're just talking to one person, that this is a letter they're writing to somebody. That ends up being a much more personal message, a much more effective message than being like, here's the broadcast. Everybody should know this. That nobody wants to hear that.
Right. The intimate one-on-one conversations is what people want, is what's going to connect. So I'm sure that, Andrew Cuomo there, I think it was Andrew, got a sweetheart deal with Simon & Schuster, got like a $700,000 advance, and he ended up selling like 5,000 copies in total, I think Simon & Schuster did. But what are your aspirations for the book? What does success look like for you now that the book has been released?
Oh, man. So you mentioned the Cuomo situation here. In a past life, I interned on a political campaign of his years and years and years ago, and it was just very disappointing to see what happened with him in the last few years, and when you see that kind of move of you use the book as as kind of leverage for fame, or use this opportunity as leverage to write your book. That I think is the worst case. That's the worst thing you can really do when you're talking about either you're betraying public trust as part of that, and you're also self-interested in doing it. What am I interested in doing with this book? I'm interested in getting this message out to as many people as possible. I mentioned my students before. I hope that this is something that can be valuable to folks that are in, not necessarily student, but in similar shoes, which they're saying, okay, I want to begin to get a little bit stronger about my messaging. And, you know, if that is in the beginning of my career, if a career pivot, or it is something that, hey, I have this great new product, you know, I invented this new widget and I want to get it out there. If this can be something that's helpful to those people that are doing great things, then I'll consider this a success.
So, you know, I wrote a book, you wrote a book. You know, there's a, for lack of a better term, it's almost like a window into our souls, into our psyche, you know, mm-hmm. who we are, what we truly believe. I think that the best articles and the best books are the ones that are, you know, as unfiltered as possible without being impolite. I mean, we don't have to be impolite to sell books or sell our story. You know, we could do it in a respectful way. But what do you think about that? It's like, you know, if somebody were to read this book, okay, would they get to understand, you know, who Ben is and what he's all about and how he thinks?
I think they'll get a good sense. I think the best books, especially in this kind of business universe where you wrote and where I've written, aren't dry textbooks that have no personality. They have to have a little bit of your own story in them. They have to have a little bit of the humility in them. You're not the full expert and stuff. And I think that you would get that. I really enjoyed the process. I got to say, I mean, I've spoken to a number of people that are saying, I kind of maybe want to do that someday. I'm so scared. I don't know if I can write the whole thing. I don't know about you, but for me, running this agency for so long, you have a lot of deadlines. You got a lot of clients. You have a lot of things that need to be put out there, and you get used to it. And you say, okay, well, I need to produce this work product by this date. And you go out and you do that. And you figure out a solution to get you there. And that's how I looked at it with the book, is saying, okay, well, I got to finish this by this time. And this is my deliverable is to write this. And it wasn't a terribly difficult process to write the book. I know I sound like a schmuck by saying that, like saying it wasn't hard to write, but it was the kind of thing where you break it up and you say, here's the outline, here's the plan, this is the research I need to do, and I need to write something, and then I need to go edit it, and you get it done. You know, it's, there's a little kind of like saying I like a lot, which is how do you eat a whale?
Yeah, one bite at a time.
One bite at a time, right? It's like you don't sit there and write the whole book. You sit there and you write a paragraph because you did the research on something and you need to write the paragraph now. And eventually it comes together. But it was a very fulfilling process for sure.
Mine was a little bit different. my process took me three years. It ended up being about 80,000 words. So it was a bit of a substantive project.
Oh yeah. Mine's about half that much. Right. So,
yeah. So, I had to put, it took 3 years, we'll say 6 months of it was production, you know, preparing for the production. Mm-hmm. But I had to put it down for 6 months because there was a point where it just became words on a page. Yep. You know what I mean? I was like reading it, but I just,
hate it a little bit too. You start to hate your own stuff.
It wasn't even, I never got to the point where I hated it, but it was certainly displeasurable, the experience. And then it was just a point where I was just wasting my time. So I had to mm-hmm. put it aside. Now I did have a good, I'll say not even good, an excellent substantive editor.
Right.
And he made all the difference in the world because he portrayed himself as the reader's advocate. And he said, Joe, I know you want to get a message out. My job is to make sure people want to read it. And that resonated with me. But I got to tell you, the funniest part was the proof editing, your proofreading. Okay. I send them out. It's 80,000 words. You know, I get back what I'm going to consider 95,000 edits. Okay. and the first day, I'm going through these edits, and I go through 4 pages out of 400.
Wow.
Clearing the edits. Okay. And then that night I had a dream. I'm not kidding you. And I woke up the next day and I said, accept all. Okay. Now, listen to my reasoning. These people are proofreaders. I will never be a better proofreader than they are, ever.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I hired them to be proofreaders. Therefore, I have to implicitly trust them. Now, my book was in 4 parts, and I had sent, I had the copy that I sent them. So I just started reading 1 part a day, and wherever I felt uncomfortable, I would refer back to the book, you know, the version that I sent them, and reconcile it.
Yeah.
You know, am I going
to
argue?
You only did it when it flagged, when it came up to you. You wouldn't do it. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, you know, where something didn't flow right, or it didn't sound mm-hmm. right, or it sounded inaccurate, or something that I wasn't trying to portray, I would go back to the original and reconcile it. And there's very few instances of those. But, you know, I guess for all those aspiring book reader or writers out there, authors, I would say, you know, trust your team.
Oh, yeah. Well, I was very happy. My publisher, Barrett Kohler, so author friendly, so wonderful to work with. But there's one part that was funny. So you mentioned the accept all button. My copy editor was very old school, and she printed out the entire book, edited it in red pen and pencil. And, you know, had for the typesetting and everything, and mailed it to me. And so I got this giant, I had on my desk, this giant stack of papers that was my manuscript. And I had to go in blue pen to match to the stitch that out from the red pen and, you know, accept or reject or edit every single one of those. I think that ended up, I would say it ended up being a different result than it would have been had it been in, you know, in Word or Google Docs or whatever, because I feel like I was a little bit more attentive to each individual item because of that. But I also was a little bit more hesitant to make major changes because major changes required me like handwriting the changes into the margin of the paper. So that was an interesting experience. Everybody I tell that is like, oh my God, you must have the last person in America that does that still.
Yeah, I would I would still be clearing the edits.
But the editing, you know, for me, I the process I enjoyed, it was when I said like the hating it was like at a certain point, it's like I wrote this paragraph and I'm reading this paragraph for the 18th time right now to go for edits. It was more like you start to question everything and you go for these waves where this is in any creative project, right? Where you go and you love it, this is the best thing ever. Oh my God, you hate this, this is terrible. And you get back up and you love it. And so you go for the waves. And what I would have to do to what your point was about setting aside before was sometimes when I got a little bit too deep in that trench there, you say, okay, you know, put a pause in this. I need to spend a couple of weeks away from it because you need to kind of need to follow your energy on those type of things instead of forcing it.
Yeah.
So that my book, you know, it's about half the length, it's about 40,000 words. It took about a year and a half. The biggest thing I'll tell anybody that is considering writing something else is that research has gotten incredibly difficult because the internet has gotten incredibly noisy and it's really hard to find statistics and studies and reliable facts and
reliable. Yeah. Stuff. Reliable.
It was a lot harder to do that than it was even a few years ago. Partly my industry's doing with SEO and everything else, but I'm lucky to have access to an academic database and I was able to pull a lot of original research that way. But there will be times where I needed to track down something that was like one statistic about like, what is the average, you know, reading level in the US or something like that. And it took me like an hour and a half to find something that should be a statistic readily available on like the Department of Education, but it's buried in some report and then some blog links to something, but that's an archived link and it doesn't work. And then this one also contradicts it. And so you're finding all these things until you finally really dig down and say, okay, this is an official government statistic and this is the one I like. And this is the one I can trust. So I'm going to include it in there. And that would be an hour and a half for one sentence in the book would be that.
Yeah, so another Mark Twain, right? There's lies, damn lies, and statistics.
Oh, yeah.
So you've sold your firm a year and a half ago, you said. Mm-hmm. You're an adjunct. So what's next? You haven't started another firm yet. Another being an adjunct and a freshly minted author. What's next?
Yeah, that's the million-dollar question, right? So I have some consulting work that I'm doing now, which I really enjoy. Some really awesome clients that have trusted me to do different projects. I've done some fractional CMO type work, which that's an interesting kind of growing field just to do from fractional work. So that's basically been like a part-time executive at a few places. And I've enjoyed those. As anybody that's run their own business and enjoyed it will tell you, is you never really lose that bug. And at a certain point, I do want to start another business. I don't think that it would probably be a marketing agency tomorrow. I feel like I did that journey recently, and it's a great ride, and I would do it again at some point maybe. But I'm excited to explore a few different things.
Yeah, I'm thinking about AI. I don't know if we ever finished that part of the conversation. You know, it's come on like a juggernaut, and you know, I don't trust it. I don't think it's mature enough yet. For instance, I asked ChatGTP how many books did Joseph Paris write, and it came back with 3. And of course, it listed the one I actually did write, but then there were 2 that I absolutely did not write, and I had no connection with the author or the subject matter. It just it pecked 2 random books, and what I'm worried about is that people, because they're impatient, because they don't look beyond their nose, are going to start accepting fiction for fact. Mm-hmm. And you know, I'm sure that this has all sorts of implications for marketing, especially in your broadest inclusion of the word. And it concerns me that, you know, how is the consumer going to be able to discern that fiction from fact or fact mm-hmm. from fiction?
So it's funny you mentioned that that anecdote of kind of the one real and the 2 not so real books, because when I was writing the first draft of this, ChatGPT was first coming online, and I say, okay, well, maybe this can help with that research problem I had before. Can you give me some studies that are related to, you know, research question XYZ? And it spits back a bunch of answers. And I look and I say, okay, well, let me go into the database and search for these studies. They didn't exist. They were plausibly named studies with authors that had never written something together, never done research together, and the studies didn't exist. Because those are the kind of authors, the kind of researchers that would do research in that area, and that's the name of a study that could be relevant in that area. And so it puts those together and says, well, this looks like an answer. My functional background is in design, and I have had a lot of fun also playing around with the DALL-E 2s and the Midjourneys and those type of things that are the image generators. The difference between an image generator and a large language model like ChatGPT is, if I ask for a picture of a kitten holding an iPhone painted by Leonardo da Vinci, but there's a lot of possible answers for that, right? There's 1,000 different paintings that could qualify as a kitten holding an iPhone painted by Leonardo da Vinci. And so they're all kind of the right answer. But if I ask you for the biography of Abraham Lincoln, well, there's really only one right answer, right? You can't be like, well, some of the biographies say that he was the 16th president, and some say that he landed on the moon, and some say those aren't all true. There's only one true kind of factual basis for it.
Right.
So what the large language models are really good at is providing something that looks like the right answer, that looks like it could be. In your scenario, it said, well, okay, Joseph Paris is the kind of guy that writes books. And so he wrote this one, and these are some other books he could have written. And he puts that in there because that is a plausible, possible biography for that. And so when people look at these things as like a source of truth, that's going to be a big point of failure for a lot of folks. But if they look at it for saying, hey, you know what? I need somebody to describe like this product that I'm selling, and I have 1,000 of them on my e-commerce shop. Right. And I need some. Yeah, that's kind of the use for it. It's not the best stuff. It's not the best communication, but the last thing I'll say about AI is the way to look at it is don't look at it as if you have like a genius superpower at your beck and call, but look at it as if you have unlimited idiots, you know, and what could you do with unlimited idiots that's what you could do with something like ChatGPT.
Yeah, I concur with that. I don't believe we could have any conversation about marketing without talking about Bud Light. And just hear me out here, because I haven't seen this argument proposed anywhere. And I think it's a valid argument. It's a valid out for Budweiser. I don't believe that Mulvaney and putting that person up as a influencer and a spokesperson for Bud Light would have been the fatal shot that it has been, or apparently has been. I believe would have passed over. Where I think Bud Light went wrong was allowing the VP of marketing to come out and insult Bud Light's customers, calling them fratty and out of touch. I think that if Budweiser had come out immediately and fired that person and walked that back and apologized for calling the customers fratty and out of touch, that would have been a much easier save. And frankly, it would have, I think, resonated with the audience. Like, you know what? Budweiser does remember who their customers are. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, it's definitely an interesting situation that's happened in that industry. And you see, I think the big thing is customer preferences are actually a lot more malleable in that space than people thought they were. I mean, Modelo is the number one beer right now in America. I haven't been following it as closely. I do know that, it's unfortunately, you know, the kind of ever-present culture wars in America have continued to, kind of fracture this country in a lot of different ways. And it's really whatever either side wants to pick up is kind of the baton at the moment for doing that. The thing that I actually see, I think you're certainly right in terms of you don't want to disrespect your customers. There's a really effective strategy in marketing, which is to say that we're not for everyone, but you have to do that with grace, and you have to be gentle about how you do that. I know like Cool Whip a number of years ago had a great ad that was like, we're not for everyone. Some people don't like us. And it's actually really great, because then you say, well, okay, we're not for everyone. So some people like us and some people don't. And I identify other people who like it. And so it's a point of pride. But you can't do that in a way that kind of insults the people that don't like you, or because otherwise if you draw that line in the wrong place, all of a sudden your share of the market's too small. I think one thing that Budweiser also did they failed to kind of commit in either direction a little bit. And so they didn't end up saying, hey, we're tacking to a different strategy and that could be very effective for them or could not be effective for them. But what they did was they went one way and then they backed off and they went another way and they backed off. And so they ended up kind of just pissing off everybody on both ends of that spectrum. And when you're a brand that is supposed to have as kind of wide appeal as something like a Bud Light, that's not going to work out well for you in the end.
Yeah, I just think that, it shouldn't be about one side or the other. I think that the real thing was that, the VP comes out and completely disrespects, Budweiser's customers, and so it was Budweiser's customers in their entirety. You know mm-hmm. what I mean? And I think it's just a mistake if you come out there and say, we want to grow our brand because our existing customers are stupid, or somehow or another, we don't want our existing customers. I don't think that was smart for her to say, but yeah. Oh, well. So just a couple of additional questions there. And by the way, Ben, I've really enjoyed this conversation. I thought it was a great interview, a lot of energy, and I absolutely wish you all the best in the success of your book. But two simple questions.
Appreciate it.
First is, in your life, or it doesn't have to be a person you know, but who have you admired, or who has been a mentor, and why do you value them such?
You know, it's top of mind because we were chatting about it before the show. But in terms of like a creative hero a little bit, so Jim Henson, the creative force behind the Muppets and a number of other platforms, I've always looked up to him in terms of how he did his creative work, how he was able to do it in a way that touched so many people and was so kind of mission oriented, as well as being just like an incredibly insightful innovator in that space. So that's top of mind. And I'll be remiss if I didn't mention, so one of the other things I do on the side is I organize an event called Queen's Tech Night. We invite all sorts of interesting people to come, and we're having Paula Scher from Pentagram come in a couple of weeks to our next event. And she's maybe the most influential living graphic designer, and I've always admired her work and the way that she captures New York City. So I'll give her a shout out here too.
Excellent. Everybody's got them. Now, there doesn't have to be regrets, okay? But can you share with us one do-over that you wish you had, and why it's a do-over, and what would you do differently?
Yeah. You know, there's, as you're saying, that there's a Frank Sinatra lyric, right? Which, like, regrets I've had a few, but then again, too few to mention. I don't spend a ton of time kind of looking in the rearview mirror, but I think that the, you know, when we started our business, I had a couple of partners who were, you know, former classmates of mine, good friends, still very good friends with them, you know, hang out with them all the time. And we talk all the time, even if they're, you know, have moved since we sold the business and people moved away and stuff. If I were to do it again, I don't know if I would go with as kind of a large group for ownership, for a partnership. Love all those guys. It was necessary for us at the time. But what I would recommend, if I'm talking to like myself in the past, you know, or my students, is you need that support at the beginning. You need that kind of companionship and camaraderie at the beginning. But then eventually you kind of get more confident in your own work and your ability, and you start to be able to do more stuff with a smaller team. If you're starting a business by yourself, it's kind of lonely a lot of times, but so it really helps to have a partner. And so this is not a saying, you know, don't have partners and this and that. I love all those guys, and I would totally do it again to have partners. But be conscious about, you know, when you're building a team, that, you know, this is maybe a team that you got to work with for a long time. And you have to, you're going to change over time, and you have to figure out a way to account for that.
Yeah, that's a challenge that I think many entrepreneurs face. That, you know, they have like the Hewlett Packard, right? The two guys in the garage, yeah. And you know, for every one of those partnerships that, you know, stand the ages, there's many others that immediately will show the differences. And if you can't overcome and reconcile the differences and understand that there is no such thing as the perfect decision, just good decisions and iterative decisions, it could make for a lot of bumpy roads. So excellent. Mm-hmm. Well, again, Ben, I want to take a moment and thank you very much for your time and coming to my podcast today. I think the conversation has been outstanding. It's always good to meet another author that has gone through the process. And, you know, congratulations on that. And I wish you much success with the book and anything else that you decide to do.
Awesome. Thank you, Joseph. This has been a ton of fun. I really appreciate it. And thank you for having me on. If anybody wants to get in touch, you can find me at bengutman.com. That's BENGUTTMANN. You know, I mentioned minimal stuff in the book. My name is not minimal. There's two N's at the end of it. You have to make sure you have both of them. And you can get your copy of Simply Put wherever books are sold. It'll be available October 10th.
Awesome. Thank you very much.
Well, thanks so much, Joseph.
Thank you for listening to The State of Readiness. You can discover more episodes and learn about the book written by Joseph Paris of the same title at www.state-of-readiness.com. You can learn more about Joseph Paris at josephparis.me/card.
All right, so that was pretty good, I think.
Awesome. I love that. That was great. That was awesome.
Yeah, I thought the conversation flowed very, very well. I got to tell you two things that happened when I published my book. I didn't mention this in the podcast, but maybe this will make it be an outtake at the end of it, you know? So the first thing was that people congratulated me on publishing my book. And the first question they would ask, so when's your next one coming out? And it's like, dude, I just gestated this thing for 3 freaking years. You know, let me bask in the glory for a minute, will you? So that was the first thing. And the second thing that people did was shared with me their aspirations for wanting to write a book. Mm-hmm. Okay, geez, I wish I could do this. I really wanted to do this. So when I published my book, it was probably 6 months. I had to put my, you know, I try to write an article a month, you know, usually around 2000 words on average. So it's not, you know, 500 words on bullshit leadership or something like that. It's like, you know, something substantive. But I couldn't write for 6 months. I just said, forget it. You know, I'm not writing. But the first article I wrote was entitled, So You Want to Write a Book?
Yeah.
All right. And it documented my journey, the decision tree that I made, you know, that I went through, why I made the decisions that I did, what the options were, and et cetera, et cetera. And at the end of the book or the article, I said my book was 80,000 words and it took me 3 years to write. This article is 13,500 words and I wrote it in 2 days. When it flows, it flows. And that's how I ended it. But I can't even tell you how many times I shared that article, because those are the two questions you're going to get. When's your next one going to come out? And I wanted to write a book. One of the things I like about your book is the hook. Okay. Like Simon Sinek made a whole career on start with the why. Okay. I mean, And frankly, I think his TED Talk is way better than his book. I mean, in fact, his book reminds me of the 500 word essay when you got back from summer vacation. You know, you took a brilliant 15 minute talk, TED Talk, and then ruined it by adding, like, you know, a gazillion words that added no value to the TED Talk. So I think that, you know, your book about distilling down that message, okay, is incredibly powerful. There's an exercise that I have. You know, I get hired to stand up these OPEX programs, you know, continuous improvement programs. And I have a series of questions that I ask people. And the first couple of questions, you know, what does operational excellence mean to you? What does success look like? And they give me this like 5,000 word, I call it a word salad. Okay, just a bunch of freaking words, and they hope that it's going to make sense. You know what I mean? But at the end of the exercise, and I think I know you'll appreciate this, I ask them, if the Wall Street Journal caught wind of your program and it was so wildly successful that they ran a special edition just on the success of your program, what would the headline say? Okay. I mean, Titanic sinks, JFK shot. You know what I mean? It's like 2 or 3 or 4 words tell the entire story. So now I'm forcing them to take these 5,000 words and distill it down to like something that is understandable and universally understandable. And then I ask them, okay, give me 4 articles that support that headline. You know, icebergs reported in the North Atlantic. Okay, there's an article. And by the way, give me 3 points of data that support that article. Now, the points of data become the KPIs for the program. The articles become the major lever points. And we have a North Star or a lighthouse that is the headline. So like it really is incredibly powerful. So I believe that you could leverage the living shit out of, simply put, by trying to get people the exercise to strip out all the non-value added static that is around their messaging that ends up leaving it subject to interpretation.
Mm-hmm. I love that.
Thank you for listening to A State of Readiness. You can discover more episodes and learn about the book written by Joseph Paris of the same title at www.state-of-readiness.com. You can learn more about Joseph Paris at www.josephparis.me/card.